children who've been killed so far in 1 month. 4,000 children, that would be hundreds of thousands of American children if that was compared to our population in the U.S. And that's not counting the over 1,000 children who are buried under rubble, some of them alive right now, slowly dying. And that's not a humanitarian crisis. The lack of medication. Doctors are operating on children without anesthesia, without pain medication. That's not a humanitarian crisis. There's over 200 children who are burned from bombing of their homes, and the doctors don't have dressings. They don't have anesthesia. These kids are getting Tylenol while they have third-degree burns all over their bodies. That's not a humanitarian crisis. I don't know what world he's living in or what world he's watching, but for those of us who are actually watching with open eyes and open hearts and open minds, this is a humanitarian crisis that we've never seen before, and it's 2023. This is unacceptable that this is happening in this modern world, and it's happening with modern weapons, and these modern weapons are being paid for by our American tax dollars. Now, your question about the children in the cancer department, they are running out of drugs. They're running out of chemotherapy. They're running out of adequate treatment. The kids who are in remission are falling out of remission. There's literally dozens of children in Gaza with cancer who are not getting adequate care, not because they don't have the facility to get that care. We built that and opened it in 2019. It's an excellent facility. They're not getting care not because the doctors there aren't qualified and the nurses aren't qualified to treat them. They are. They're not getting care because their hospital right now is under attack. It's been hit by it was bombed 2 days ago. The doctors don't have access. The nurses don't have access. The children themselves are living in a state of absolute terror, as was mentioned earlier. If we want to talk about the mental health situation, it's affecting the entire population in Gaza Strip, and it's going to be a generational conflict or a generational issue. How do you solve an entire population that's been exposed to conflict and war? Children. Over 1 million children have been traumatized now, and they're going to live the rest of their lives with this trauma, and it's impossible to treat it. Why? Because the source of the trauma is not going away. It's not post-traumatic stress disorder. It's current traumatic stress. And we can't solve it. We have a mental health program. We can't heal these children. We can't heal their hearts. We can't heal their souls. And we can't heal their bodies until this conflict stops. And it's not going to stop until there's a political will on the part of everybody who believes in peace, in justice, in freedom, in equality, to take a stand and put an end to this situation once and for all.
Steve Sosby, I want to thank you for being with us, president and founder of Palestine Children's Relief Fund, speaking to us from Kent, Ohio. And Dr. Barbara Zinn, pediatrician who traveled to Gaza October 6th to support the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. She was finally evacuated through the Rafah border crossing weeks later and arrived back home in Grand Junction, Colorado this week. Next up, we'll look at how President Biden's refusal to support a Gaza ceasefire could impact his reelection chances next year, as his support among Arab Americans is plummeting. Back in 30 seconds.
Trump, I'm Boris, connected like plug sockets. Love, profit, wanna mug us off, bruv, you must stop it. One topic, low-key and 47, unlock it. One topic, low-key and 47, unlock it. Exploiting our difference, they poison the infants. A voice from the distance, our choice is resistance. Parasites wanna snatch a life, so I slap them twice when I grab the mic. Nationalize, I abdicate in passing when we fraternize. Revenge of the pedagogues, censorship never stops. Tell a friend to tell a friend to tell a friend to tell the cops. Sent to offend the mob, lengthen the renaissance. Heroes getting shot, left to rot, legends lost.
Out here it's madness, got to hold your ground.
By Palestinian Jordanian group 47 Soul featuring Low Key. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. No ceasefire, no votes. And in November, we remember. Those were two chants we heard Saturday in Washington at the largest rally in U.S. history for Palestinian rights. Protesters denounced President Biden for refusing to support a ceasefire in Gaza while sending more arms to Israel as it continues its month-long bombardment that's killed over 10,000 Palestinians, including 4,000 children. Polls show Biden's support among Arab Americans is plummeting. This is Nahat Awad, the head of CARE, that's the Council on American-Islamic Relations, speaking at Saturday's rally.
No ceasefire, no votes. No ceasefire, no votes. No votes in Michigan. No votes in Arizona. No votes in Georgia. No votes in Nevada. No votes in Wisconsin. No votes in Pennsylvania. No votes in Ohio. No votes for you anywhere. If you do not call for a ceasefire now, we will make our voices heard more and more. In November, we remember. In November, we remember.
Nahad Awad, head of CARE, said he was speaking in his own capacity. We are joined now by Jim Zoghbi, president of the Arab American Institute, joining us from Washington, D.C. It's great to have you with us. And if you can talk about these figures that I'm sure the White House is looking at carefully. In 2020, President Biden had something like 59% support of the Arab American community. Right now, it's at something like 17%. James Zoghbi, if you can talk about Biden's stance right now on Israel and Gaza.
Thanks, Amy. It's been a long time since we've been together, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. Look, the poll is one that we did to get a read on the community. I have never seen in the 27 years we've been polling, my brother and I have been polling Arab Americans, we never saw a movement this dramatic over this short a period of time. The last time we polled Arab Americans was just a few months ago, and the drop since then has been even more precipitous than the drop since 2020. This issue resonates. It's big. It's important. It also is part of a general national trend. Arab Americans are not immune from what the rest of the culture is feeling, and that is that President Biden just is not in control of his own presidency and how he is being portrayed to the American people and to the world. They didn't elect a Reaganite foreign policy advocate, a neocon who was fighting for freedom there to have freedom here, that kind of rhetoric that comes from the White House. They voted for somebody that focus on a whole bunch of domestic issues to bring domestic peace and tranquility after 4 years of Donald Trump. And that's not what they've gotten. And I think that coupled with the Gaza situation, most certainly, is driving these negative numbers. They are deeply disappointed with the position he's taken on this conflict, and they just are jumping ship.
And Jim Zoghbi, could you talk about the some other aspects of the poll, what the support for a ceasefire was, and also whether there were gender or age or religious differences in those you polled?
What was really significant was that across the board, when you get numbers that high, a flip that high or numbers in the 70% range on several questions like support for a ceasefire or how important is the Palestinian issue to you or how disappointed are you with the president's performance on this issue, all of those numbers were two-thirds or greater. When you get numbers that great, you expect across the board to see the crosstabs reading that way, and we did. There was virtually no difference in terms of majorities, regardless of religion, regardless of whether born here or immigrant or a gender or age. Pretty much across the board, there's frustration and deep disappointment with this president. And the question I keep getting asked is, can Biden win him back? The visceral reaction to this issue is so great that in order to do that, something dramatic has to come from the White House. And I'm not sure that the president has the wherewithal to do it. Look, I've heard two things from people at the White House. The one is they're not going to vote for Donald Trump because they don't want they don't want back what he was doing during his 4 years. And so they'll come around in a year. I told them that. When I heard that, I said, that's insulting and dismissive. You have to earn that vote. They might just as well stay home. They might vote for Cornel West. They might just not vote at all. And it's not a given that young Arab American women who want control over their bodies and their health care, that young, that older Arab Americans who want protection for their you know, Medicare or an expansion of health care. It's not clear that they're going to make the decision to vote at all if they don't have something to vote for. It worked the last time. Vote for me because I'm not the other guy. I'm not quite sure it'll work. It'll work this time. And, you know, I've got an article coming out in The Nation tomorrow that makes the point that it's not just Arab Americans who are affected this way. It's young people. It's progressive Jews. It's Black, Latino, Asian voters. There's a significant decline that this president is encountering across the board. And you know, Gaza is playing into it. It is a sort of a canary in the coal mine issue. It's one that sort of is the speaking to a broader sense of dissatisfaction. And the White House has to get a handle on that, not just dismiss it.
And speaking of broader sense of dissatisfaction, you worked with Bernie Sanders for two of his campaigns. How do you understand his insistence only on calling for a humanitarian pause and not a ceasefire?
And Juan, let me play a clip of Bernie Sanders, who was interviewed this weekend on CNN.
I want to just clarify one thing, Senator, if I might. You support a humanitarian pause in Gaza. Some of your fellow progressives say that there should be a full-on ceasefire, which would require an agreement on both sides to halt the fighting. Do you support a ceasefire? And if not, why not?
Well, I don't know how you can have a ceasefire, permanent ceasefire, with an organization like Hamas, which is dedicated to turmoil and chaos and destroying the state of Israel. And I think what the Arab countries in the region understand, that Hamas has got to go.
That was Bernie Sanders being interviewed by Dana Bash of CNN. In fact, just a few days ago, Bernie Sanders' office was occupied by a group of progressives protesting that he wasn't calling for a ceasefire, among other senators. Jim Zogby.
Look, you know, I have no idea. I've called the senator, didn't get a call back, left them a couple messages, text messages, didn't hear back. And I'm disappointed and frankly confounded. I don't understand the thinking here. One could easily take the sentence that he spoke about you don't have a ceasefire with a group like Hamas that blah, 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 and stick in the Netanyahu government of the most extreme rightists in the country that are today, while under the cover of Gaza, taking armed settlers to evacuate Palestinian villages and force people to leave their lands, leave their orchards and their homes. This is a crazy extremist government, and yes, Hamas is a group that has done and does evil things, just like the Netanyahu government does evil things. The question is, that's why you need a ceasefire, and to say we can't have peace with them. It's what the Palestinians say. We can't have peace with the Netanyahu government. But the problem is that the United States has to act like the adult in the room, and we haven't. We've been the cheerleader, the coat holder, the enabler, and the funder of one side, digging the hole deeper every single day. And the result is that we're locked in a conflict here on Israel's side that has no good end in sight. Those who think on this path we'll eliminate Hamas, forget what happened in Beirut in 82. Forget what happened in Lebanon in 2006 or what happened in Afghanistan or Iraq. You don't eliminate. What you do is you create the conditions for something more virulent afterwards. You're not going to get rid of Hamas. I mean, the million plus people who've been forced to leave their belongings, their memories, the neighborhoods that they lived in, now reduced to rubble and flee to the south where there's no infrastructure to take care of them. The families of the 10,000 who've died, 4,000 of whom children, they're not going to say when this is over, if it's ever over, oh, we love Israel, let's have peace. There is going to be the seeds being planted today for Hamas 2.0 or something more virulent. And I don't understand how the folks in the White House or the State Department just don't get it and say, this is not going to end well. At the end of this path, with the exception of more dead bodies, more anger, and more virulent extremism, we're going to be right back where we started. It's a failure of the United States, not of Hamas and of Israel, but the United States. We have not shown the leadership that we ought to be showing, given the fact that we're funding this damn thing, to stop it.
And James Ogby, you've been for decades now an expert in public opinion and polling, and it's not just the United States or England and France where we're seeing unprecedented demonstrations in support of the Palestinians and opposed to Israeli bombardment and the invasion, but also across the global South. In the rest of the world, outside of the Western countries, there's virtually no support for the United States policies and Israel. I'm wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah, and we've just finished a poll in 12 Arab countries. I should add, my brother does the domestic polling. We played the game of Risk, and he took one side of the board, and I got the other side of the board. I do polling in the Middle East and some polling in Europe. We've done some polling on Ukraine and with European countries, their attitude toward it. But in the Arab world, we've blown it. There wasn't actually much of a bounce when Joe Biden got elected. The damage done by George W. Bush, the disappointment in Obama making promises in Cairo that excited people and then blaming the Arabs for not delivering on the promises he made, and then Trump and the chaos of 4 years. People have told me there, we've been on a roller coaster with your country for the last 20 years, and frankly, we're dizzy right now. We don't know what we're getting. They too hoped for calm when Joe Biden got elected. And instead of calm, they have two big wars, and they're being forced to choose. And frankly, they can't, because they have decided, as European countries are deciding, that they have to make their own decisions and they have to do what's in their interest. And their people are watching what is happening in Gaza and saying, hell no, we're not going to do this anymore. Even countries that have made peace with Israel, their public opinion has turned decidedly against Israel. And decidedly against the prospect of living in harmony with that country. Damage has been done here. And I don't understand in all of my conversations with people at the White House and the State Department that they don't just get it. I don't know what they're taking in the morning that makes them think today is going to be a better day. Israel's going to kill more people and Arabs are going to say, let's have peace with Israel. That it doesn't work that way. And I've been down this road now for the last 40, 50 years doing this work full time. And frankly, it gets worse, not better. And those who think you win a victory in a war where you kill lots of civilians, their heads aren't screwed on right. And frankly, we need new thinking on this. But the guys in the White House aren't capable, I think, of that kind of new thinking. And it's deeply disturbing, because the hole we're digging is one it's going to take a generation to get out of.
Jim Zogby, I wanted to ask you a few quick questions. I see you have a TV behind you, and I was looking to see if there was a crack in the screen, because I was wondering of your comments on the coverage by the mainstream media, a word you almost never hear. And I'm not talking about Fox. I'm talking about MSNBC and CNN, places where you appear. Rarely do we hear the word occupation. Mm-hmm. And why that is so significant in understanding how to end this. We're not just talking about Gaza. We're talking about the West Bank. When you had the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, saying right before October 7th, you know, it's peaceful there in the Middle East. We're moving on to other issues. Yet at that time, you had at least a Palestinian a day being killed in the West Bank by settlers or by the Israeli military. Now, I think since October 7th, the number is well over 150. The OPT, the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Gaza and the West Bank. Question how we should be talking about this issue, what you think would be the most honest? And do you think there's a difference between Biden and Trump, not on other domestic issues, but on Israel-Palestine?
Joe Biden promised us a lot. He issued not just a platform plank that was one that they made some accommodations to us about, but they issued a separate policy statement for Arab Americans. And I remember when we wanted language that talked about the equality of human needs and rights, and they issued that statement that both Israelis and Palestinians are equally deserving of, and then there were a litany of words that followed it. Three and a half years later, we're still waiting for the delivery on the equal promise of all the Palestinians have gotten has been a green light for Israel to run roughshod over the West Bank, take more land, build more settlements, demolish more homes, more restrictions on Palestinian rights, Jerusalem the same, and Gaza worse. It's been a huge disappointment. And frankly, I recall some interesting things in the platform debate that that still troubled me, because I remember back in 88 when I was negotiating with Madeleine Albright on the Dukakis-Jackson platform issue. We wanted the word Palestinian in the platform. And she told me, she said, if the P word even appears in print in the Democratic Party platform, all hell will break loose. I told her, I said, don't play Chicken Little with me. The sky's not going to fall. We can do it and get and live with it. I mean, it's not rocket science to say there are Palestinians in this conflict. The party had never even mentioned the word up till then, and it didn't that year either. What troubled me in 2016 and 2020 was that we couldn't get the word occupation in the platform. They wouldn't use the word occupation, which was Trump language. Trump wouldn't use occupation either. In fact, they changed the Human Rights Report from reporting on the occupied territories to putting it all in one thing. That was the U.S. Ambassador Friedman, Trump's ambassador, wanted it that way. There was no occupation. The Biden administration deals with it as if it were an occupation in language, but not in practice, not in practice. We have not put conditions or terms on Israel to deal with Palestinians as an occupied people. And so we've kind of come a ways, but we haven't come anywhere at all, from not using the P word to not using the occupation word. Frankly, it's a bit of a semantic thing, but Palestinians are living under a brutal occupation. It's an apartheid occupation. And they are also being victims of a genocidal attack on Gaza right now that is killing the infrastructure, killing the people, forcibly evicting over 1 million people from their homes in the north to move south, where there is no capacity to care for them. They're living in tents without water, without power, without health care. The hospitals in the south are not capable of dealing with all the issues. And the Israelis are treating the people in the north as if, as the general says, they're all animals and deserve to die. If that's not genocide, I don't know what is. And yet this administration, if they can't use the word occupation, and for God's sake, they won't use the word apartheid, they can't use the word genocide. Something horrible is happening to these people, and this administration is turning a blind eye to it. And I'm sorry, but when they say we're deeply concerned, if that's the best they can do, when we're providing $14.3 billion additional this year on top of $4 billion, when we're providing diplomatic cover at the United Nations, that is not enough. And frankly, this, what is happening in Gaza, is not only happening on our watch, but we're complicit and enabling it. Sounds harsh, but it's the reality, and they have to deal with it. And there are going to be electoral consequences, and I wish it weren't so. Last thing on earth I want to see is a Republican of the type of Donald Trump or whoever comes after in the White House. But they have to earn the vote and establish that there's a difference. They haven't done it.
James Zoghbi, president of the Arab American Institute, joining us from Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Donald Trump took the witness stand Monday in a civil fraud case brought by the state of New York against the former president, his sons, and his businesses. Trump was repeatedly admonished by Judge Arthur Engoron for testimony that veered off topic, lashed out against the court and New York Attorney General Letitia James, whom Trump called a political hack. James is seeking $250 million after accusing Trump, his oldest two sons, the Trump Organization and company executives of inflating the value of assets. The judge has already ruled Trump liable for fraud. The trial determines how much the Trumps will pay in damages. For more, we're joined by Lauren Artani, reporter for The Guardian U.S., who's been attending the trial. Her most recent piece headlines, Speeches and Grandstanding, Trump Scores Few, If Any, Legal Points in Court. So you were there. Lauren, if you can describe the scene, but also contrast his hurling epithets, getting angry, his face getting red, with the documentary evidence that's been presented in this trial.
Yeah, the scene was pretty incredible to witness. I mean, not only is there the typical media circus that surrounds Donald Trump, but then you also have it in a very, you know, what's supposed to be civilized courtroom. It's very quiet. There are no cameras or recordings allowed. So really, it's just the prosecutor asking Donald Trump, the witness on the stand, these questions. So what we saw a lot yesterday was Trump would often kind of get into these rants, as I mentioned in my piece. And really, it kind of was reminiscent of what he was like at his rallies, where he would really go off a bit off topic on election interference or, you know, crime in New York City, kind of, you know, saying that New York Attorney General Letitia James, you know, who's been attending the trial every day, you know, kind of making the case that she's wasting her time, saying that the case is unfair. And of course, what the prosecutors have been doing with Trump and his adult sons last week is showing these documents where essentially the Trump family signed bank agreements, you know, term agreements with these banks who gave them loans, saying that their financial statements were fair and accurate. So you have a lot of these documents, emails, these, you know, things that are being pulled up in front of Trump. And, you know, he's basically saying that, you know, he kind of relied a lot on this idea of a worthless clause, which is basically that the banks knew not to take, I guess, the Trump Organization for its words when it came to these financial statements. And of course, the judge in his pretrial judgment had written that the worthless clause argument is in itself worthless. So we saw a lot of that yesterday, a lot of Trump basically, you know, doing what he does, except, you know, the only person that really matters in this courtroom is the judge. And he even seemed to kind of, you know, express a lot of frustration toward him.
And Lauren, at the beginning of the trial, Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer, testified that Trump had directed him to manipulate financial statements. How does Cohen's testimony fit into the broader context of the trial? And was Trump questioned about that testimony?
Yeah, so Trump wasn't questioned directly on Michael Cohen's testimony, but what Trump was asked, so basically Michael Cohen testified that he, along with two of Trump's top finance executives, there's Alan Weisselberg, who used to be chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, and Jeff McConney, who is the Trump Organization controller. Basically, he would say that, you know, Trump would direct the three of them to essentially increase his net worth on the financial statements. Cohen, you know, basically wasn't necessarily that specific on, you know, the assets that he was asked to increase on the financial statement, but there was briefly a document that was pulled up that he had confirmed that, you know, Trump in handwritten notes had basically instructed them to increase their assets. But Trump wasn't questioned directly on Cohen's testimony. That was a few weeks ago.
We just have 30 seconds, but what do you think is the big takeaway? Trump testified now. He's expected to testify again when the defense presents their case. His daughter Ivanka is going to be testifying. Talk about the significance overall, if you were surprised by anything, Lauren.
Right. Like, I think, you know, what we've been seeing a lot lately is I wrote a piece a few weeks ago that was basically talking about how what we've been seeing is this trial within a trial. We have the trial that's in the courtroom. You know, there's no jury. It's just a judge basically deciding whether Donald Trump would be paying a $250 million fine. But then there's also the trial that he sees as more important, which is in the court of public opinion. We definitely saw that yesterday. We're seeing that last week with Trump's sons when they, you know, were saying that they don't recall, that they, you know, in angry times, they also were very much, you know, kind of going on their own little angry kind of rants. And so, yeah, a lot of what we're seeing is just politics in the courtroom.
Well, we're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. Lauren Artani, reporter for The Guardian U.S. Happy belated birthday to John Hamilton and Emily Anderson. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hi, we are Liars.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.